Ukraine has just passed its 18-month anniversary. As a result, we thought it would be a good time to have a look at the state of play and where things stand right now. It was on the 24th of February 2022, if you guys remember, when Russian troops crossed into Ukraine and starting Europe's first interstate war since World War II. Since then, the West has provided military, economic support to Ukraine, whilst Russia has been trying to conquer territory and grind out victory. The outcome will affect the global balance of power, and this is what makes following this war particularly important. So we've got Geopolity founder Adnan Khan here to explain this all to us and unravel it all. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. Good to be here.
Now, let's get straight into it. So after a year and a half, tell us where things are standing right now.
Okay, Yusuf. So a year and a half in many ways can be a long time in a war. So I think, Yusuf, we sat down in February when it was the 1 year anniversary. And at that point, you know, a year had gone by. And, you know, the things that were clear at the time were that Russia had a bad start to the war. Russia bungled the capture of the capital of Ukraine, Kiev. And they were really forced to make adjustments and make quite a few amendments. And really, Yusuf, looking back now, this actually proved to have actually helped them quite a lot in the war. Now, looking back at the time, it was seen as a massive failure. They had to give up effectively the north of the whole country. That meant 40,000 troops withdrew from the north of Ukraine. What actually happened since then, Yusuf, is these 40,000 troops were sent then to the east and the south of Ukraine, and they actually played a major role in occupying territory in that area. So Russia, Yusuf, it captured the area from the east of Ukraine, which they call Donbass, all the way down to Crimea in the south. That's a 500-mile front and around 100 miles into the interior of Ukraine. So Ukraine was put in quite a difficult position. They had to sacrifice lots of troops to stop this advance. And what they did was they undertook two key operations to stop Russia's advance. So in the south, in Kherson, Ukraine effectively advertised a major operation they were going to do. Vladimir Zelensky, he traveled to all Western countries to drum up support. So the element of surprise, Yusuf, went completely out the window, which is the normal operating procedure in a war. And when Russia was focusing on defending the south of Ukraine, Ukraine actually shocked everyone by carrying out an operation, opening a second offensive in the north of the country in Kharkiv. Russia was caught off guard so badly that Ukraine actually managed to push them so far back, Russia was actually forced to call in reinforcements. In the end, they surrendered 4,000 square miles. And I remember at the time, so much was actually made off this. So come September, Russia recognized it really didn't have the force numbers to win. So it called for a mobilization of the army, called for an extra 300,000 new troops. And that was seen as Russia's first wave, first attempt at conquering Ukraine had completely failed. So as the winter set in, Yusuf, the fronts became static, and really Ukraine began preparing for the spring offensive in 2023. So this is where things were, Yusuf, when we spoke on the one-year anniversary in February. So what's happened since then? So 2 months ago, in June, Ukraine launched its much-delayed spring offensive, and its aim really was to cut a line through the Russian front all the way to the Black Sea. So in effect, they wanted to split the Russian front from the east all the way down to the south. Now, this offensive, Yusuf, it's not gone well. In fact, it's not gone well at all. And the reason why it's not gone well is because what Russia's been up to since last September when they called for mobilization. What Russia did, Yusuf, is it spent all this time preparing for this offensive by building fortified defensive lines in order to blunt Ukraine's offensive. So these fortifications were absent in Kharkiv and Kherson. So what this shows you, Yusuf, is Russia has actually learned from its losses. It's actually learned the lessons and it's actually made adjustments. So Ukraine generals, Yusuf, they've actually confirmed that these defensive line of fortifications has really made it difficult for the Ukrainian army to make progress in their offensive. So Russia was able to build these because it carried out low-level operations to keep the Ukrainian army busy and not get in the way when they were building these fortifications. So what we're talking here about, Yusuf, is barbed wire, trenches, hidden gun ranges. So when the Ukrainian army carries out an offensive, they're going to basically get caught off guard. And this is where really Wagner came into the picture. Wagner was actually quite central to keep the Ukrainian army busy so they can build these fortifications. So currently, Ukraine's second offensive to take back Ukraine has virtually failed. And Russia hasn't even used its 300,000 newly mobilized troops yet to carry out its offensive. When Russia does do this, Yusuf, Ukraine would already really be exhausted. So in 18 months, Yusuf, despite the problems Russia had at the beginning, despite the bungled operation of the north of the country, it's now learned and adapted. And actually now on the battlefield, Russia has the upper hand and Russia has the advantage.
Ukraine, what can it actually do about this situation? Because it doesn't really have many options available to it.
Yeah, this is the million-dollar question, Yusuf. There's actually a discussion taking place in Ukraine at the moment for months, the military and the politicians, that should Ukraine just settle with what it's got and enter into negotiations? And also, should they just accept what they've got and actually get ready for the expected Russian offensive with all the new mobilized troops? So even the status of Ukraine, where they are, there's actually the dispute, there's differences amongst them. Now, the problem Ukraine's got, Yusuf, is it's completely dependent upon Western arms and Western equipment and Western support. Russia is fighting its own war, despite the fact that it's been impacted economically. It's relying upon its own factories producing the weapons and going to war. That's not a reality for Ukraine. Ukraine is completely dependent upon the West. So they've been asking for fighter jets, long-range missiles, air defense systems, because they believe this would actually make a difference. Ukraine's actually been saying that the reason why it's struggling is because it doesn't have air superiority. It keeps getting attacked by the air. Its columns and its armored troops keep getting attacked by Russia because they can't defend its airspace. So what we're seeing here is the West has been slow or effectively not agreeing with the air element of the war. So a lot was actually going against Ukraine even before this offensive began. You know, these strategic issues really were going to put a dent in whatever offensive was going to happen. I think the other problem is the offensive Ukraine is carrying out is what we call a large-scale offensive. Now, Ukrainian armed forces have never really carried this out before. They're only partially trained to carry this out, so they've got limited experience. So they were always going to run into trouble. So really, the only way that they can change this or alter this is if a number of external things happen. So for example, the West could embed their troops with Ukrainian forces to act as a multiplier effect. So this is what they did in Afghanistan. This is what they did in Iraq. The West could provide more heavier weapons, which would actually make a difference. The West could provide more offensive weapons, long-range missiles. They could provide more drones to make it easier for Ukraine to dent the Russian defense. But all of this is based on Western sentiment. And what you find is Ukraine is always begging for more. And the West end up having a long debate what they do, what they don't want to give. And really, it seems the West don't want to escalate the war to a very high level. What they want is, here's what you got, Ukraine, and you just got to do the best you can with the cards we've delivered to you. They're not prepared to do any more. And what that means is whatever Ukraine does is actually limited in what it can do. It has a very limited hand that it can play with.
What's the reason the West don't want the war to escalate? Wouldn't it be in their interest to stop Russia's advancement?
So if you go back to the beginning of the war, you know, there was a lot of talk of this war could expand beyond Ukraine. It could go into NATO territory. There's a lot of talk about nuclear warfare. So what you find is the help and the support the West have been providing, it stayed within certain parameters, not gone beyond that. So for example, there's been a few times where Ukraine's carried out attacks well into Russia. It seems that they've got collaborators within Russia, actually. So there's been drone attack on the Kremlin. But these have been very far and few in between. None of these show the Russian people that the war's now coming to them, that the war's in mainland Russia. And so what the West have been saying is they want the war to remain within Ukraine. They don't actually want Ukraine to be carrying out attacks in mainland Russia. Now, in many ways, if Ukraine did do that, you're opening up another front. So this would complicate Russia's effort. But also the West are thinking about, do you really want attacks in your countries? Do you want the KGB to carrying out assassination attempts and things like that? So in a way, what the West have done is, we are going to provide you weapons. We are going to replenish your stocks. Beyond that, don't expect anything from us. So the West really, in a way, they've handcuffed themselves, self-imposed handcuffs, and they don't want to go beyond that.
You mentioned Wagner earlier, and they've been on the news quite a lot. Could you tell us a bit more about their role? And also, do you know the attempted coup that took place back in June? What was their role in that?
So one of the good things, Yusuf, with these sort of podcasts is when you look back, things are a lot more clearer compared to at the time. So, you know, geopolitics, we've been following this war since the beginning. And 18 months down the line, there's things we know now that we didn't necessarily know at the time. So the role of Wagner is probably one of those things where things are a lot more clearer now. So the entry of Wagner was in Bakhmut, which is a not very strategic town just outside the Donbass area. So it's literally on the front lines of where both Ukraine and Russia are fighting at the moment. And I think it's important we put the Bakhmut operation into perspective. When Russia was building its fortifications, that was the most vulnerable time, where if Ukraine launched attacks then, there would be no fortifications now. So what Russia needed is, it needed to keep the Ukrainian army busy, but it needed to keep them busy in hit and run attacks and not exhaust too much resources. So the solution to this was, is forget using the Russian army. You want them to build the fortifications, use Wagner. So Wagner went into Bakhmut, and under a lot of fanfare, Russian media gave it a lot of coverage. And because Russian media gave a lot of coverage, and the leader, Prigozhin, of Wagner was constantly giving interviews, constantly making social media posts about what was going on, the Ukrainians believed that this is a really important city for Russia. They're pulling loads of resources. So this was absolutely perfect for the Russian army, because it meant they could get on with building a long, wide range of fortifications. However, what happened was a couple of things. Firstly, this actually caused quite a lot of tension between the Minister of Defense, Shoigu, and Gerasimov, the head of the army. What they didn't like was, they felt Wagner was getting too much credibility. The army is doing the legwork, it's doing the hard work. Wagner's involved in one town, which is not even strategic, and Wagner seems to be getting a lot of credibility. Wagner historically, Yusuf, has had quite a slick media presence. They're very good. We're in Africa, we're in Mali, we're in Burkina Faso, we're in Guinea, we're in Niger, and they've got a big media arm. You find the Russian military doesn't. Russian military, nobody wants to go into the military. So this actually caused a lot of tension between them. And what started happening over the last few months is, the defense ministry stopped providing resupplies to Wagner. And the Wagner had started complaining, we're not getting bullets, we're not getting ammunition, we're not getting resupplies. And this all came to a head in June, where there was an artillery strike in Bakhmut, and the Wagner had actually believed this came from the Russian military. Looking at the direction and where it came from, he actually believed it came from the military. And this is what then culminated in his march to Moscow and his attempted coup. So really what happened here was, this was a dispute between the head of the defense ministry and the army. And this is a typical internal dispute, because in any country, you always get disputes between different departments over resources and things like that. The thing I found quite interesting, Yusuf, looking back now, is about over a month ago, there was a conference in St. Petersburg where the African leaders all came there. Now, Prigozhin was also at the meeting. So if Prigozhin was a coup plotter and his coup failed, usually with these people, they get court-martialed, they go to prison, or they get in exile. The fact that he was at this key meeting, he actually gave a speech, it shows that it hasn't broken his relationship with Putin. And in fact, when he did the coup, he actually made clear that the coup was not against Putin. It's not against Moscow. He actually said the coup is against the defense head and the army head. And his way of doing the coup was his march to Moscow. So what this shows is, he hasn't lost his position. He's still in the Putin inner circle. And it actually shows us that this episode, I still actually have a lot of questions. You know, if he's doing a coup, why would you still keep him in your inner circle? He's not trustworthy. But it seems as though he is trustworthy, and Putin's still keeping him close.
Now, if we look at another aspect of the war, the whole economic aspect of the battle, the West, it seems like the West has tried to cripple Russia economically with sanctions and what have you. How's that going?
So the economic war, Yusuf, was the other pillar of the war. You had the physical war where the West can provide weapons. And then their main contribution really has been the economic war. So Russia is still the most sanctioned country in history. It's been cut off from the SWIFT payment system. Sanctions were put on all different Russian officials, put it in a circle. And Russia was banned from sporting tournaments, from international competitions in order to isolate them. Now, with sanctions, Yusuf, they are only as good as those who implement them. So the West, so we're talking about the G7, we're talking about America, they were the ones that largely introduced the sanctions. But what you find is countries like China, countries like India and Turkey, they've not implemented the sanctions. If anything, they've actually taken advantage of the fact that Russia has got other partners that it can't sell to. So probably the main sanctions were the fact that Europe stopped buying energy from Russia. So most, at least half, over half of Russian energy used to go to Europe. That customer is no longer there anymore. So what Russia has found is customers such as China, such as India, such as Turkey. So they've tried to offset the loss of European revenues from the sale of energy to these countries. Now, these countries can't replace Europe, but it is good enough for Russia. That's what I mean by, if the whole world doesn't implement these sanctions, Russia can find holes in these sanctions program. And that's what they've actually done. Russia's revenues from energy have reduced, but what Russia's done is made use of its reserves that it had over the years. And what Russia's actually been doing is been selling to other countries at a discount. And this oil that other countries have been buying at a discount has ended up in the West as well eventually. So Saudi Arabia, for example, it's seen a business opportunity. It's been buying cheap Russian oil and actually selling it at the market rate and making a profit. So really, these sanctions can only work if the whole world implements them. However, Yusuf, I do feel in the long run, if this war continues, it will start to impact Russia's economy. If Russia is an energy export economy, it's a commodities, raw materials exporter. If the rest of the world are not buying this from Russia, in the long run, this will catch up with Russia. So Russia needs to really wrap this war up. Otherwise, it will keep hurting its economy. But for the moment, you know, all the talk of crippling Russia will collapse. That definitely it hasn't happened.
It's interesting you mention Saudi Arabia, because they organized a peace conference on a couple of weekends ago, the weekend of the 5th and the 6th. It was attended by everyone except for Russia. Now, what's the status of the negotiations and how do you see the end game, so to speak?
Yeah, so peace negotiations are interesting, Yusuf. They've not been getting much media coverage, but in some form or shape, they've actually been taking place on a parallel track. So Russian and Ukrainian officials actually negotiated on the third day of the war. They met in Belarus. Nothing came of it because both felt that based on their battlefield performance, they're in a stronger position. So do they need to negotiate? So when Russia's invasion wasn't going well, Ukraine felt, do you really need to negotiate when we're doing really, really well on the battlefield? Since then, Yusuf, a couple of peace plans have emerged. So we saw that the first real peace plan was Zelensky's 10-point peace plan. This was back in December. He called for a global summit when he presented his peace plan to the G7 summit. And what we've seen is there's been a conference in Denmark, and then now there was one this month in Saudi Arabia. Now, his peace plan is quite broad. It calls for energy security. It calls for defense of one's borders. Probably the two key elements in this peace plan are that the territorial integrity of Ukraine has to be accepted, and secondly, that Russia has to give back whatever it's actually taken. So this peace plan is actually quite broad. It doesn't just address the current issues in the war. It actually addresses the long-term issues between both countries. After this, we saw a peace plan by China. This was in February, and China called for a freezing of the conflict and for dialogue. It called for security guarantees, and it actually quite brazenly called for the protection of Russian citizens. So Zelensky actually said it's a decent peace plan and he was happy to meet Xi Jinping. However, the West rejected it, and at that point, really, the peace plan died a death. So this meeting in Saudi Arabia was interesting because Saudi Arabia was supposed to be on the sidelines. Saudi Arabia, since the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, has been isolated. But what you're seeing now is Saudis being brought out into the limelight, is being brought out of isolation. And the fact that the meeting took place in Saudi makes that quite interesting. The British have just announced that MBS will do a visit soon. So what that shows you, this meeting Harford was really about the rehabilitation of Saudi Arabia. But probably the main focus of this meeting was, it was actually to get the global South on board. So we're talking about South Africa, we're talking about Brazil, we're talking about India, these sort of countries, some of the BRICS countries. What this conference was about in Saudi is, let's get these guys on the same page as Zelensky's 10-part peace plan. And actually, they made quite a lot of progress. So it's a small step. If you can get all the key countries on the same wavelength of what peace should look like, then what will happen is these countries will actually pressure Russia that now's the time for peace, because there's a broader impact on them as well. So in a way, Yusuf, this was a meeting to arrange another meeting. But the fact that the terms of what that meeting will be, they're agreeing on in some form or shape, is a level of progress. So what it means is, when eventually Russia, Ukraine and Russia do talk, this peace plan will be mainstream. This peace plan will be the peace plan that they will try and impose on Russia. Obviously, from the Russian perspective, if you've got the advantage on the battlefield, they will talk when it comes to negotiations from a position of strength. So that's really what's going on now. So I do generally feel, Yusuf, that the tide now is really shifting to Russia's side. They will try to gain more territory. And once they have that, they will then, in that context, come to negotiate. So Ukraine will be in a weaker position. Russia will be in a stronger position.
Now, finally, I've got a few questions, almost like a quick fire type question. So I want your view on a number of different issues regarding the war. It's the things that we know now that we didn't know back then. So first one, who blew up Nord Stream?
So, Yusuf, we don't know the exact parties, even 18 months into the war. However, Seymour Hersh, he reported the pipelines were blown up by the US with the help of Norway and Finland, the two countries who have displaced Russia as Europe's main energy suppliers. So that's what we know at the moment, but I think in time, probably more of the details will come out.
Why did Russia invade Ukraine in the first place?
So 18 months on, Yusuf, we still don't know. We know from the way Russia prosecuted the war that the decision seems to have been made very quickly. But yeah, the actual reason we don't know, I mean, this is going to be the million-dollar question. When the war's over and in years to come, we find out how the decision made. Why did they go to war? They had other options on the table. They didn't take them. So the exact reason we still don't actually know, Yusuf, 18 months down the line.
Is there still a threat of a nuclear war?
So what is now clear after 18 months, Yusuf, that is just a threat. It was just posturing. Putin said at least 5 times he mentioned something which was on the line of threat of a nuclear war. And when you use the same threat so many times, it ceases to be a threat. So that's why it's been a long time now Putin has spoken about using nuclear weapons or the threat of a nuclear war. And looking back now, Yusuf, I think what was going on is when Russia started the war really badly and when things were really bad, it would talk about a nuclear war really to deflect and to threaten the West. And he's used that card so many times now, it's just irrelevant. You can't even really use it now. So it was much talk about nothing, really.
Okay. Why has Russia not targeted Western supplies via Poland?
So that's a very good question, Yusuf. If Ukraine is in this war because of their support from the West, all of that is coming via Poland. Ukraine has a border with Poland. Russia has never undertaken a strike there. And I think this could be a couple of reasons, really. I think one, Russia didn't want to escalate, especially when the war wasn't going really, really well for them. I think secondly, it would seem now, looking at where things are, Russia's focus is on the east of Ukraine. If they can take over most of the territory in the east, job done, objective achieved. So do you really want to carry out attacks on the Polish border, which is a NATO country? This would probably lead to the West increasing what they're doing, and that would make the war even more difficult. So whilst we can look at this war and we feel, why is Russia not doing this? Russia's objective really isn't to take over the whole country, it's to take over as much of it as it can. So really, you don't want to bring attention to that.
Okay, why did the wheat deal collapse?
The wheat deal collapsed. Now, what is the wheat deal? When the war started, because Ukraine and Russia are the world's largest suppliers of wheat, wheat prices went through the roof. Countries like Egypt, many African countries, they fell into economic crisis. So a deal was made between UN, mediated by Turkey, and then Ukraine and Russia, that there'll be an agreement that wheat exports, those ships should be protected. So Russia agreed that it would not attack the ports and the ships that carry wheat to international waters. And this became the wheat deal. Now, Russia did attack some of these, but overall, they didn't. And this eventually led to wheat prices to reduce and the economic problem in places like Egypt to reduce. So this deal was only for about, 9 months. And when it was up for renewal, everybody thought, despite where the war is, this would get renewed. Now, what we know now is when Russia agreed to this deal, Russia actually has some terms. And those terms were, is some Russian companies would be brought back onto the SWIFT system and that some of the sanctions would be removed. In the 9 months of the deal, none of this actually happened. So Russia actually felt at the renewal of this deal that they'd been used, that they actually compromised and gave in to something the West needed, but it's actually got nothing back in return. And when the African leaders were in Russia a month ago for the African conference, he actually mentioned this. Putin actually said that I got used. We agreed to the deal. The West got everything out of it. We got nothing. So on that basis, he never renewed the deal. That's why the deal's collapsed. That's why there's a big worry now that wheat prices will go through the roof because the supply of wheat will drastically reduce now.
And final question, what has China's role been in all this?
So Russia, Yusuf, would hope that China is firmly on Russia's side and that China is supporting Russia. But I will say, Yusuf, China has played a bit of a schizophrenic role. And the reason for this is this war and its impact and its fallout is just not in Chinese interests. China relies on the global economy. China relies on global supply chains. China relies on the West importing and consuming its goods. And this war has disrupted them. So you find that initially China was quite critical of what Russia did. China wasn't happy that Russia didn't even tell them they were going to invade. Then at UN votes, China has sided with Russia and has criticized the West. And this has really been the general theme. China, it depends on what day of the week it is. Sometimes it comes out in support of Russia. Sometimes it remains neutral. So some of the UN votes that put sanctions on Russia, China remained neutral. China didn't even side with Russia as well. And you know, fundamentally, this is what it shows us. It shows us that the interests of China and Russia are not actually the same. There may be in some areas they overlap. So, you know, the role of the West, Western institution, the global liberal order. But actually beyond that, they actually got different interests. China, when it looks at Eurasia, it sees economic corridors. It sees trade routes. It sees supply lines. And it wants access to these and it wants to build them. Russia, when it looks at Eurasia, Russia says sees its sphere of interest. Russia believes it should have a monopoly and privileges in Eurasia. So this is a complete opposite between the two. So really, China's role is to protect its own interests, and its interests are completely in line with Russia's.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolitics.com. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. Thank you for listening.